Okay.
So we are being recorded tonight so that others can listen later. We have Doug Lipman with us, and the title for tonight is Listening Beyond the Border. So I'm going to ask everybody to *6 to go on mute, and then after about half an hour or so, Doug will open us back up for conversation, and we'll *6 ourselves back in if you have something to say. Everybody good with that? I'm going on mute, too.
Okay. Before you unmute yourself a second, Gail, I can just be sure you can hear me.
Yes.
makes me nervous. Okay.
I can hear you, but you will be speaking into the void.
That's okay. I can handle the void if I know that I'm actually connected.
Okay. And if other people drop in, that's fine. You know, we'll just let them be however they are, unless there's noise in the background of, you know, small children screaming or things like that. Okay.
Got it.
Thanks.
So this listening beyond the border refers to the fact that, you know, as well as we listen to stories and we listen to each other tell stories, there's a border that happens when we cross into the full expression of emotions. And this whole emotion thing is very interesting. I mean, like, take crying. You know, children are born knowing how to do it very well, but it's one of the few bodily functions that our society assumes has no use at all and should really never be done. So, you know, even elimination, which we think of as distasteful, at least we acknowledge that it has a value. But the expression of emotions, crying, for example, is treated like you know, we know what it is. It's breaking down. It's being weak. It's something you should never do. And we've all kind of learned that. I'll tell you how I became really aware of how strongly this border is enforced. The person with a dog should do *6, Gail, because you can mute yourself by doing *6. Good, thank you. So I'll tell you how I learned about how strictly this border is enforced, and how strongly, was from my parents. I was middle-aged, and I had them come visit me, and they spent most of a day doing things I wanted to show them and showing them my life. And then time came, I think it might have been 6 p.m. or something, and they wanted me to see something of theirs. It was their favorite TV show. And it was a show called Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. It was a story about a woman doctor in a small town in the Old West, and it was all about her relationship to this town that she's kind of been dropped into. We're now at a doctor. If you're on the line, would you please do *6? I hear somebody making good amount of noise. Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, it turned out that this particular episode, that just by chance was the one on the day that my parents and I were watching, was a follow-up to the previous one where she had evidently had a miscarriage. And she had not grieved the loss of her baby-to-be. And in this episode that we were watching, the townspeople were noticing that she wasn't really with it, and they were trying to get her to face the grief and to cry. And the whole episode, everybody's trying to encourage her to pay attention, and it ends with a rainstorm. And she is alone in her little isolated cabin. And she finally begins to cry. Now, up until now, my parents have been kind of narrating the program for me a little bit, talking to me. Like, oh, yeah, you don't know, but last time this happened. And, oh, that character always does that. So they were talking to me. As soon as Dr. Quinn started to cry, they stopped talking to me, and they started talking to Dr. Quinn. My mother said, "You don't have anything to cry about." That was striking. My father said, "Hey, look on the bright side," and he started to tell her jokes to make her distracted from crying. The crying scene went on pretty long. Excuse me. The crying scene went on for maybe 3-4 minutes, and my parents kept talking to her the whole time, trying to make her stop crying. And I was astonished by this display of all these techniques to make someone stop crying. But afterwards, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, imagine when these people were faced with their firstborn, who was a baby and therefore cried, how many of these did they use to try to get me to stop? Because they were using all these when there was nobody, actually, someone who wasn't present in the room was on TV, who actually wasn't on TV at this moment live, was actually had already done this before, who wasn't even crying real. She was an actor, and they were still constantly having to say all these things to make her stop. So this was a little easier for me to notice because a few years before, I had already had an experience to cross the border myself. One time I was at a folk festival thing, and my friend Debbie, I just ran into her there, and she looked really upset. I said, what's the matter, Debbie? Am I disconnected? It looks like I might be disconnected.
You're here.
Oh, good. Oh, I see. I looked at the wrong button. Okay, good. All right. So, Debbie, what's the matter? She said, somebody stole my purse. I said, oh, that's terrible. You know, it was a Sunday. She couldn't do much about calling in all the things that were missing from it. She said, no, you understand, my car keys are there. I have spares, but they're at home. That's 45 minutes away. I said, would you like me to drive you? She said, oh, I would love that so much. So I drove her home, got her car keys, drove her back, got her car, drove her home to make sure everything was fine. And I was feeling kind of good. I'd been a good helper to her. And I wasn't in a rush now because the festival was over already by now anyway. And so, you know, that was fine. And she said, Doug, there's one more thing I'd like before you leave. If you've joined and you haven't done *6 to mute you, would you do that, please? Because we're hearing the sound from your phone on the line.
Oh, it's star what?
*6. Thank you. She said, would you do one more thing, please? Would you just listen to me? I need to cry. It's like, what? Okay. She said, no, I'll be fine. I am fine. But if you just listen to me cry, that would help me sort of, you know, I have a lot of feelings because I just had all this happen to me. Okay. And I guess I could do that for a while. And so she began to cry. And she kept giving me instructions. Just look really pleased with me. Okay, I'll do that. And it kept going, and she said, you're doing good. So I kept with it, and she cried for a while, and then she said, okay, that's great. Thank you so much. I said, okay, well, I'll be going. She said, no, wait, there's one more thing I actually would like from you. Would you let me give you a turn? Partly, I would like to feel like I'm not just helpless, and I can help someone too. And partly, I'd like to give you this gift. I don't know I want to do that. But you don't have to cry, but just try it. If it doesn't work for you, you don't have to do it. But just take a turn, just to be, whatever happens, just let whatever happens happen. So, okay, I guess so, sure. And I just noticed how I felt. And at that moment, I did feel something. You know, I had just really been able to help someone well. You know, and there were times in my life, my childhood, when I actually, you know, hadn't been able to make things better for someone who was upset, and it felt good, but it also brought up tears. And pretty soon I was crying, and there was Debbie just looking at me like she was pleased with me, and I kept crying. And as I cried, these images would come to me. And pretty soon, this one image came and stayed. They were all from my childhood, but this one in particular was a particular time that I was, 9, 10. I was sitting on the carpet in our dining room on the floor, and I was looking up, and there was a dining room table, and there was my dad. Just the two of us were in the room. My mom was somewhere else. She was upset. Everybody was upset. And my dad was kind of crawling inside his beer. He was sitting there with his elbows on the table, his hands around his big beer glass, and his face, he was gone. He was somewhere else. And I remembered feeling that I just wanted to connect with him. I didn't just, come on, Dad, you and me, just be here. And he was gone. And the more clearly I thought about that, the more I cried, and the more I cried, the more clearly I thought about it. I cried for about 45 minutes, and right around that point, something shifted. And I still was seeing that scene, but now I wasn't seeing it from my child point of view, looking up at him. I was seeing it from above, and I could see me on the floor, and I could see him at the table. And not only could I see us both, I also could feel what we were both feeling. I could feel what he might have been feeling. Well, after that, I thought, you know, that was kind of like storytelling, where, you know, I want to tell the story and be able to feel what both people feel. And it began to make me think, well, maybe there's a value for a storyteller in a process like this. Now, time went on, and I began to make this a part of my life, where I would get together with people and just listen to each other, you know, cry, laugh, yawn, shake, whatever we needed to do, talk. And I came in touch with not just the grief of my dad being not there all the time, but the real fear. And my mother had been a nurse, and she had been trained in the 30s to objectify patients. You know, you must not be involved. You must, you know, treat them efficiently. And so she learned to treat me like an object. And she would do things, I think some of them weren't necessary, but she would kind of feel good, like she was doing things to me. And some of those were terrifying. And some of those, I felt I was going to die. So there was a huge amount of terror. And, you know, it took me a year to even figure out how to begin to let myself feel that afraid. And then worked on it for a lot of years. Well, along this time, I had embarked on a program with my parents of appreciating them, of telling them things they'd done well as a parent. You know, I was in middle age. I kind of figured out that it's hard to be a parent. And the thing you want most of all is for your children to do well. But maybe second thing to know is that you didn't do such a bad job raising them. And so I figured my parents deserved to know the things they've done well. And so I began, you know, when it was a birthday or something like that, I'd write a card, or maybe even write a song, or make a little story or something that would just kind of tell them something they've done well. And for my dad, this was easy. There's a lot of things. He'd been the one who had been my stalwart, the one I could really count on, who always thought well of me. For my mom, it was harder. I was mostly mad at her, and I began to learn that was because I was so afraid. But I did assemble together some special birthday of hers, and so I assembled together, I had maybe four or five, maybe six, really good memories of her, things where she'd really been a good mother to me. And, you know, a lot of years, but still, it's only six. Well, we got six. So I took four of them and I put them in a song. And so in the song, you know, each one was a verse. So it was four lines or eight lines just to quickly describe the story. And then I felt like I'd kind of shot my whole wad. One of them was a time when I had actually... I was 9, 10, 11, something like that. I was out, saw a boy, a little younger than me, about to bully a really young child. And I tried to stop him, and in stopping him, I knocked him off his bicycle, and he skinned his knee. His mom got really mad. A few minutes later, showed up at our door, expecting that she's going to yell at me, but no, she rings the doorbell. I'm in the yard, and my mother comes out, and I think, oh my gosh, my mother blames me for things where I'm not even there. I am in big trouble. And to my amazement, my mother was calm and and supportive of me, asked me my side of the story, and refused to be cowed by this hysterical woman. And so that was a pretty good story, and I thought, well, maybe I could tell that as a story. And I worked on it. I would come back to it every few years trying to make it work as a story, and I couldn't make it work as a story. And then years later, after my mother had died, actually, I took one more crack at it. Now, a lot more years had gone by of working on the terror and letting myself be terrified in a safe place and to shake and to cry and all the rest of it. And this time, I discovered the same thing had happened. It's been a much longer process, but the same thing had happened with that episode about my father, where I could this time go back to this episode and not just feel my terror, but also feel what all the other characters felt. And I could feel my own experience even more strongly. And one of the things I noticed was that I felt everything like it was mythic, right? I mean, this woman was like a troll, and my mother was like a dragon being awakened from sleep. And so I created a story that I call Troll versus Dragon on Lee Street. And at this point, I had done enough emotional clearing out that I could both get the big picture and really imagine my experience in depth and completely. And if there's time at the end, I'll actually tell you maybe that story. But let me tell you that once I learned this would work for me, I began to try to find ways to help people use the same idea themselves, so we didn't have to stop when we came to the point of having emotions. And in fact, on the other side of that barrier was the possibility of processing our emotions and therefore being able to imagine and understand what we were having emotions about even better. So I remember a group of seventh graders. I was doing this whole middle school, and I was doing 3 weeks. And every day of the first week, I went into every seventh and eighth grade classroom they had, and I had a couple hours, I think, and I taught them a little about story, and I taught them to interview their families. And this was the project I was hired for, was to get them telling family stories. And so the second week I came back and said, okay, I got them warmed up. And I remember the very first one, 8 o'clock in the morning or something, very first class, got them warmed up and said, okay, is somebody willing to tell a story that you heard from your family? And this boy, seventh grade boy, raised his hand right away. Come on up. So I had him stand up there and go ahead, tell your story. And I saw it on his face what happened. He was really ready to tell his story, but then now he was standing and he was looking at the 25 or 30 kids in his classroom, and he froze. If you are on the line and you haven't yet done *6 to mute, would you do that now? It's *6. We'll mute you. Thank you. And there's one more person I hear their noise. *6. We'll mute you. So he stood there and he froze. And I said, do you remember the story you were going to tell? And he shook his head like, no, I don't actually. Up to now, whenever I try to do this in a situation like this where I didn't have a lot of safety with people, I would always be kind of nervous about how I introduced crossing this border, because I was aware, you're not supposed to do this. And so somehow, even though I didn't say that I was nervous about it, people picked that up, of course, and they thought, well, we're not supposed to do this. And so it didn't work very well. But by this point, I've been doing it long enough that I kind of got relaxed about it. So this time, the boys up there terrified, petrified, literally. And I said, hey, would you like to learn what storytellers do when we get afraid? And he said, uh-huh. And I said, okay, everybody, we're all going to do this. Everybody stand up. So he wasn't just the only one standing up. Everybody standing up. I said, you know what we do when we're afraid? We laugh. And we're going to spend 1 minute now laughing. And so I started laughing. And, hey, they were seventh graders. They had all this embarrassed laughter stored up that they weren't allowed to let out. So it didn't take that long to get them all going. They were a little embarrassed about laughing, but they needed to laugh, so they did it. And a minute goes by. We're into a minute 15 seconds or something. And the boy has stopped laughing. Everyone else is laughing, but he's starting his story. I say, okay, hold on again. I think he's ready. Sit down. And he had just gone with no turnaround, with just instantly, one second he's laughing, the next second he's got the story and he's telling it, and he told it really well. He was really focused. He was really imagining. It was really authentic. There was no embarrassment left in him at all. So that encouraged me to maybe think of other ways. So I began using this in my coaching workshops. When someone seemed to have something they couldn't imagine or a feeling that they weren't quite able to be in touch with, so that it was coming out not the way they intended in their story, I would offer them this choice. And many people chose to do it in this safe situation. You know, and if one person cried or whatever, then the next person felt safer. So usually there was sometime the first day somebody would choose to do this, and then it would kind of spread and the safety would spread. And I asked Noah Baum if I could tell a story about her, and she did. In fact, she reminded me some of the details of it. But Noah is a terrific performer. If you haven't had a chance to hear her show called A Land Twice Promised, which is about her. Noah's from Israel, is really living in the U.S., and her friendship with a Palestinian woman also living in the U.S. It's a terrific show. It's really a terrific show. But anyway, Noah came to a workshop and wanted to tell us a hard story about her mother. And she tried to tell it, and she couldn't quite decide what it was about, and it wasn't really working for us as listeners. And I said, so Noah, you know, what's the feeling you have here about your mother? She said, oh, I'm so mad at her. I'm so disappointed. She disappointed me in this story, and she disappointed me again and again. And so I encouraged her to go with the feeling, and she ended up crying. And it became clear that she wasn't going to be ready to tell this hard story about her mother in a way that the audience could really take as a story for them until she had figured out how to love something about her mother as well, to tell a positive story about her mother. And so over a period of a couple of years, she began to really do that work and to cry about her mother. And in time, she was able to fashion a story about a positive story, about a very sweet thing that her mother not only didn't disappoint her, but actually exceeded her expectations and was very thoughtful about her. That's a story that she doesn't quite take on stage yet, although now that her mother's dead, she's ready to take another go at it. But she's told it in a few situations, and it people have found themselves able to enjoy it and to be moved by it. So this is just little experiences that I hope give a picture of how this border, which we are all learned to shy away from, actually doesn't serve us. That we have a way to heal these emotions, and it's the very thing that we stop is the healing, and that makes these painful experiences have lasting harm rather than just be temporary harm, because we don't let ourselves heal them. And the effects of that are we don't really have the ability to think well about the experience when we're reminded of it, and we aren't able to imagine it fully, because if we really imagined it, we'd have to do some crying first. But when we do that, crying or shaking or whatever, but when we do that, then we regain that ability to imagine and to understand. So, at this point, I would love to have anybody who has a question to do *6 and just say your name, and I'll see if I can answer it. Any questions or even comments? *6.
Hey, Doug.
Yes, who is that?
This is Alton Chung calling from Vancouver, Washington.
Hey, Alton. Good to hear your voice.
But aren't you pretty much describing our self-work? I mean, if you're telling a hard story, you've got to do your own self-process work to really get your arms around the hard story so that you can hold that emotion of that story and allow the audience to actually have their own experience of whatever the story brings up for them.
Absolutely. Now, a lot of people think that, that their self-work does not include crossing this boundary, and so that's the thing I'm pointing out. But you're absolutely right. This is for me the essential self-work of any story. The work of the artist is to be able to do the healing, which turns out in order to do that you have to go across this no-no line in our society. Was that a satisfactory response?
Yeah, I mean that's what it kind of sounded like to me. I mean, certainly.
Yeah.
You know, when you're telling hard stories, especially, when you tell stories, when I tell stories like this, it's because it's touching on something that is important for me to get clear in my own life.
That's right.
Important for me to tell. And,
yeah. Right.
You know, if I don't feel like I'm connecting to the material, it's probably, you know, something inside of me needs to get healed, and I have to go and find that and, you know, work that out for myself so I understand that why is it bringing up my own emotions, why is it triggering
me?
And then once I understand that piece and work through that piece for myself, then I can bring all my emotions up to the surface and hold it there.
Yeah.
Allow the audience to experience, you know, whatever their experience, whatever the story is touching on them, and so they don't have to be caretaking me. That fine line is also trying to make sure that I've done my work and I'm not
talking right.
from the stage.
That's right. In order to tell the story as the helper to the audience, you first have to tell it as beneficiary to a listener, a willing listener. So you absolutely have this. You've nailed it as far as I'm concerned. I'm in 100% agreement with you.
Doug?
Yes.
It's Judith. RC had weren't there five... integrating techniques, the shaking, crying, laughing, yawning. What was the other one?
I think of them as forms of emotional discharge.
Yeah.
Or you can say that they're the outer signs that this inner healing process is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And crying with tears is one of them.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, shaking. Sweating, hot sweats and cold sweats are both there, but they're different. Yawning, laughing, and interested, non-repetitive talking. Right? So.
Wait, you know, say that again. Interested.
Non-repetitive talking.
Uh-huh.
So that in my mind, that's like, oh, I have to tell you about this, and it's just like you can hardly stop from telling about it. That
uh-huh.
is itself. Form of healing. Now, people will go through the story and they'll do it the same old way with kind of flat affect. You know, oh yeah, my mother used to do this to me. And that's not healing. So that's repetitive, non-interested talking.
It's interesting. My husband went, I forget what it was. It was, you know, one of the New Age type things he went to, and you had to tell your saddest, you know, most humiliating or deadening story again and again and again and again. And after about the 10th or 12th time, people just started laughing. You know, because the story that you defined your own misery by after, you know, got through 12 times, it just became like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm saying this again. it got absurd.
Yeah. Nice.
I have a comment, Doug. It's Gail.
Hey, Gail.
Revelation, I've been working with Doug as a coach for more than, I don't know, 20 years or so? Ooh.
Yeah, I think so.
Anyway, so familiar with this process both for myself and watching other people, and there's sometimes for some people some fear that this is, you know, I didn't come here for therapy, you know, the self-revelation in the work sometimes is uncomfortable for some folks. Some people don't mind. But what amazes me over and over again is the leaps that people make and the depth of the story and the richness of the story that they're telling, their understanding of it, whether it's traditional material or personal material, because it's not always just about personal stories. Folk tales and traditional stories can also bring up feelings because they're, of course, they're personal or we wouldn't choose them. So I do sometimes describe the workshops as therapy and aid of storytelling, but the focus is storytelling in this kind of coaching. And yet, there has been some healing that I've observed and that I've experienced in this process. So healing through the art of storytelling that has been very powerful. And also, by the way, you get a really fine story out of it.
Doug?
Yes, who is this?
This is Noah.
Hey, Noah.
Hi. I wanted to just add something to strengthen a little what you described, because it was much more than what you described.
Good.
I just want to give my perspective of that moment, because it was a huge transformative moment for me in my relationship with my mother and in my ability to begin to tell stories about my mother. And that particular session and a couple of others did more than 20 years of therapy. I'm not joking, because I have been in therapy for that long.
Yeah.
So I wanted to just say that what I think it was, because I couldn't believe the power of it, but I think what it was is that permission that you gave and the way that you were able to just not only sit with the grief, but to really invite it in. And I don't know how else to describe it, but I did not sit there imagining that I would even go to crying.
Mm-hmm.
And what came out was so powerful, and your ability to stay there and stay there and stay there and stay there.
Mm.
Stay there. I think that's the unique thing, because like what you say, we are conditioned to, the minute we start feeling that, maybe we'll allow ourselves to cry, but then, at least me, I always would start apologizing and say, oh, well, sorry about that. You know, I didn't mean to cry like that, or I didn't mean to.
Right.
You know, we can't fall apart. We can't fall
apart. Exactly. Yeah.
And all of a sudden, there was a place to fall apart, but it wasn't therapy, and it wasn't falling apart. It was part of the creative process. So, thank you.
Thank you for adding that. I really appreciate it a lot. Other questions or comments? These are great.
If nobody has, would you like to tell us that story?
We're scheduled for an hour, right? So the story's only 15 minutes. So I might see if I can stimulate a little bit more comment time here yet for a little bit yet. You know, my friend Annette Simmons says that, and she's a storyteller, particularly a business storyteller, and she says, you know, human beings have been having strong emotions for a lot of millennia. We are actually built to face them. And it's kind of a limited section of human experience that decides we can't face them, that we have to avoid them. And that comment kind of put me in looking like, okay, where are there other places? Where are there places where this is taken for granted, so you don't have to make a thing out of it? It just happens. And I find it pretty common in some of the religious traditions. You know, Jesus wept. St. Francis is trembling all the time. And in the stories of the Baal Shem Tov, the Hasidic Jewish mystical figure who's been important to me in stories, and as Gail says, I've told a lot of personal stories that are about him, personal for me, that are about him. And he's always trembling or weeping or something in the course of this. So this is only news for those of us who have been raised in a society that has denied access to this. It's actually not news in the scale of human history.
Okay, Doug, here's the question then. I'm just going to open this up and say, you know, the first one is you know, they researching the story, and they all of a sudden it hits a nerve for them, and they want to tell a story, but they're having trouble working with it because of the material itself.
Would
you suggest that they do to go and try and help them get through some, so to identify what's going on with them and work through some of that stuff?
Right. Well, again, this is a natural healing process, so all we have to do is two things. One is to create the conditions under which it normally works, and secondly, since we're in a society that has enforced this boundary and has armed guards along it, you know, like my parents, trying to make sure that nobody crosses it, we have to overcome the misinformation that we have. So for me, you know, when it comes up in a coaching session, either individually or in a group, I will, first of all, it depends on the relationship, but I'm trying to create the safe situation. Here's what it needs in general to work. You need to, in order to be able to do this work, to let this natural process happen, you have to be not in the middle of an actual trauma. Right, so a lot of people have experienced this, like you have a fender bender or something, and you pull over at the side of the road, and you know the police have been called and everything's taken care of, and then you start to shake, right? Like it's over, and you start to shake, and that's good, right? Because you know we wouldn't have lived very long as a society if every time you got afraid you didn't run or fight or something, you shook, right? But when it's over, you need to shake. So you need to have your attention on two things. One is that it happened, and the other is that it's over. And that balance can go, for a particular person, a particular moment, can go from all one end of, oh my gosh, it's over, it's over, it's over, to oh my gosh, oh, and it happened, and I need to tell you about it. And it's some balance of that, and it'll shift. So if you can create the safety of somebody listening, standing guard in a way, holding the space for you, because you know, when you're doing this, you can't be like defending yourself from the environment. So you need someone else there. It isn't, you can never do it alone, but it's to really do it most effectively over the long term, you need someone there. So if there's someone there who's like, you're fine, I know you're fine, I'm happy to hear everything you have to say, everything you do, I'm just, you're fine. So do we have that safety? The question that will put their attention where they seem to need to go. And you don't know in advance. You try something. So, you know, how did you feel about your mother? You know, in the case of Noah, some question, I don't know if that was exactly it, but something like that, that was exactly right. And then, boom, out it comes, right? For somebody else, you know, that will put them more into that, you know, my mother, blah, 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 blah. And that's not the healing process. That's just the rehearsing of how you felt for a long time but haven't really addressed. So in that case, you know, do you have any pleasant memories of your mother? That could do it. That could be exactly the right thing. Or, you know, so how did you, what did that mean for you that you you were terrified of your mother? I just never felt safe. Well, do you have an image of feeling safe? What would be your perfect image of feeling safe? So what I'm doing with this is trying to move someone toward it's over or toward it happened as they seem to need. So I don't know if did I answer the right question, Alton?
Well, again, I just was, to open it up to say, you know, for someone just falling into this stuff, what kind of things can they start doing? Or does it sound like they really need to start working with another person? Or ask those questions of themselves?
Well, it's okay to do it by yourself, but you're not going to get the same results as when you have somebody else. I really think it's part of our human evolution that we expect we will do this when someone else is holding the space for us. It's like we have to close down a little bit for processing, and so we can't be the one to deal with the environment. So if someone else is there making it safe, then we just easier to do it. Now, you know, a lot of us have feelings about being with people, right? Because people have been the source of some of our trauma. So sometimes you have to find out how to be the person that's useful for them. But by and large, the safe environment, the person there, and then this sort of gentle shifting of your attention till you find the place. When you find the place where your balance of attention between it happened and it's over is just right, you will spontaneously start to do the healing that you need. I think at this point I'll tell my little story and just leave a few minutes for maybe a closing circle, people to say things they liked or something like that, or whatever Gail had in mind. This is a story. I'm just relearning it, so this is not a festival grade performance of it. But I thought you would. This is a story that maybe I could tell you and demonstrate the possibilities of getting out of the stuck place that I was in so long around it. Some people say that fairy tales, stories like that, are the natural emotional language of the child. And that makes sense to me because, you know, your feelings aren't something that you can see or touch with your hand. And so it can be a little difficult to begin to understand them, to recognize them, to even have labels for them. And fairy tales are good for this because these kind of stories, the everything's extreme. You know, it's a lot easier to tell, oh, I'm really afraid or I'm really happy, and to be able to tell those apart than I'm kind of lukewarm and it's mixed. And the characters are simple. They're either good or bad. They don't have a lot of complexity. And that means you can begin to use the images from the story as little ways to identify the inside states you feel. Okay, fine. Well, I can tell you that as a child, there was a time when I began to be drawn to this kind of story. It's true that I've been drawn to this kind of story over a period of years, but it shifted. I mean, I went through a whole period of World War II stories, right? I mean, my father was in World War II, and then there were books in the library about World War II, and I just read one after the other of those. And trains, they were a big thing for a while. And then I fell in love around the age of 9 or so with a book of Knights at the Round Table. And I began to sort of see the world in those terms. So one day, my fellow knight, my friend and me, were out on our steeds, okay, bicycles, exploring the kingdom neighborhood. We were only 2 blocks away from my house, and we were looking for just someone else to play with, and we saw little Johnny Marotti. Now, Johnny Marotti, I knew already who he was. He was a knave. And I could see him right now coming toward the street, and he was dragging this long, thick rope. It must have been 20 feet long. And you could tell by the way he was looking around and the way he was moving it, he wanted to whip someone with his rope. And there we were standing on our bicycles, you know, watching him walk toward us, and he took a look at us, brandished the rope, and then realized we were both bigger and we were two of us, and he just turned away, and he saw little Kathy Koblowski. She was like 5. And he started running toward her, and she started running toward home. He got on his bicycle with the rope still in his left hand, dragging behind. Now, Kathy only lived like a half a block away, but on his bicycle, he was going to get to her before she got home. Well, I looked at my friend. I mean, this is a damsel in distress, obviously. So I began to pedal. We both began to pedal. And I got ahead, and I was catching up to Johnny Marotti, but I could see I wasn't going to be able to get all the way in front of him and cut him off before he got close enough to swing that terrible rope at Kathy. And I'm just behind him. I'm seeing on the pavement the rope is going by, this dragon from his left hand on his left handlebar. And this thought was injected into my mind. I wonder what happens if I run over the rope. And my 9-year-old sense of physics wasn't adequate to predict exactly what would happen, but I was pretty sure I shouldn't graze the rope because it could maybe pull my wheel out from underneath it. So I pedaled really hard, got up far enough that I could turn, make a right angle turn and cross that rope at 90 degrees. And the second that my tire touched that rope, the physics were spectacular. The rope stopped dead. So did Johnny's left handlebar. And Johnny went off his bike in a very satisfying manner, I have to admit. And then he started to cry. Uh-oh, are you okay? Got off the bike, tried to help him up. He wouldn't let me help him up. I could see that he'd skinned his knee and was bleeding a little bit, and he just ran him back into his house. Okay. I guess our job is done. But there was something about having done the job in a way that left somebody hurt that made me and my fellow knight think we should maybe stay a little bit close to the courtyard, my front yard. And so we went back there, put our bikes down, and just stood there, not like people who had maybe done something that we were going to get in trouble for, no, just like two guys just shooting the breeze. In 3 minutes, we heard a wailing, and we could see at the end of the block, someone's coming close. It was obvious pretty soon who it was. It was Johnny's mother, Mrs. Marotti, and she is coming, and she has Johnny by one hand, and she is pulling him. I mean, her arms are going back and forth like the pistons on a freight train. I mean, she has this incredible energy, and every time her arm goes forward that's holding Johnny, he stumbles, and he has to kind of run to catch up a little bit, and her she looks so angry. I mean, there is definitely steam coming out of her nose and her mouth. And her eyes are yellow and big. I mean, they're so big that they almost form a single yellow headlight in the front of her face. She is coming at us. And I know who she's coming at. I know what she is. She's a troll. The troll has eaten Johnny, and the troll is going to come eat me. I am in trouble. What do I do? I don't know what to do. And there are other children playing in their yards between us and Mrs. Marotti. And as she comes by them, they freeze. They look at her. What is going to happen? They're looking for a train wreck. But from my point of view, I know what's happened. They've been turned to stone. And then as she passes them, they're still entranced. They begin to walk slowly after her to see what's going to happen. She's coming down, 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 walking to my house. She's going to eat me. I know she's going to eat me, but no, she turns down my walk, and she glares at me as she walks by. I was smart enough not to look her in the eye. And she walks up to my door and rings the doorbell. Oh, no. This is even worse than being eaten by a troll. My mother is there. My mother works nights. My mother, she can be very crabby any time, but she's especially crabby if you wake her up. And you know what? She doesn't turn into a dragon and attack me in front of other people unless the other person is another adult that she's embarrassed in front of. I realize these are the last 5 minutes of my life happening right now. Should I go run and hide? No, then the troll will come after me. I mean, should I go inside? No, the dragon will eat me. I don't know whether to hope my mother's there or not there. The door opens. My mother is there. My mother blames me for things that happened when I wasn't there. You know, if I was there, I was definitely my fault. And here I actually purposely ran over somebody's rope, and he got hurt. There's no escape for me. And Mrs. Marotti, standing there, squeezing little Johnny's hand, and he's wailing. And when my mother opens the door, my mother is calm. My mother says, "Can I help you?" And on cue, little Johnny goes down to a whimper level. And Mrs. Marotti, her troll eyebrows knit down, she says, pointing to her son, "Look what your son did to my son." And my mother looks and sees the kid that skinned his knee. And my mother says, "Oh, what happened?"
"What happened? Your son knocked my son off his bicycle."
I know this is the point where I'm going to be turned on, and I'm going to be, my mother's claws are going to come out, the wings are going to sprout from her back, her long neck is going to reach out, and she'll either grab me in her teeth or in her talons, and she will dismember me. But she keeps smiling, and she faces me and she says, "Doug, what's your side of this?" what's my side of this? I didn't know I was allowed to have a side of anything. Well, this is encouraging me. And besides, all the children who were slowly walking, they've all arrived now, and they're forming a little ring around my front yard, just a safe distance away to watch the battle between the troll and the dragon. So I have an audience. Well, he was on his bike, and he was going to whip little Kathy with his long rope, and I tried to stop him, and I ran over the rope. I didn't know that it would hurt him. And my mother looked at Mrs. Marotti, and she said, "It sounds like your son was being a bully, and my son was just trying to stop him from hurting someone else." Mrs. Marotti's skin began to turn leathery. You could see her hands starting to take the shape of troll claws. She began to breathe. "What do you expect me to do about this?" Pointing to Johnny one more time. And my mother is still smiling. She says, "I don't know. Maybe you should sue us. Sue us." I am stunned. My mother has said sue us like it was no big thing. Mrs. Marotti thinks it's a big thing. She has lost human speech. She's just spiraling. And finally she turns and she grabs Johnny and takes him back with her. And now Johnny, he's evidently seen this transformation before, because he cries louder than ever. His mother is full troll and is taking him back to the den where she will do unspeakable things to him. We're all in the yard, just frozen. We don't know how to respond. We don't say a word. Except for my mother. My mother turns at me, smiles, and goes back inside the house. There were maybe 12 children, most of the neighborhood children, watched that. And not one of us ever spoke about it again. It was too important to speak about. It was like we had not just seen a miracle in our minds, we had actually experienced a miracle. I mean, we knew that the life was us children. We'd all learned it. It was us children against the adults. And yet here, a dragon had turned into a gentle queen and stood up for one of her knights. For me, it was like I had another mother. I had the scary mother, and I had this mother, and I couldn't integrate them. So I kept them inside myself, like two characters in a fairy tale.
Lovely. Thank you, Doug.
You're welcome.
We have 5 minutes remaining, so I do want to leave a chance for comments, but there's a couple other little bits of business to take care of. Just a reminder for people to join the HSA listserv if they'd like to get information about the pre-conference coming. Also, there'll be another teleconference with Sydney Solis on the 5th of April and another with Elizabeth Ellis on the 29th of April. So April, we get two of these. Also, this one, the recording will be up in a few days, and if you're on the listserv, you will get notification of that, too. Recording will be on the website. So I thank you, Doug, and you can entertain another question or do some summarizing, whatever you'd like, until we need to stop at 10.
Okay. Sure. Are there any other questions or comments?
Well, more of a comment, maybe.
Yeah, who is this?
This is Allison Cox out in Washington.
Hey, Allison.
Hi, Doug. And when I talked to Gail about your upcoming conference tonight, one of the things that it brought to mind is when I do storytelling over in other countries,
I have a very different reaction when emotion comes up in a story.
Oh, good idea. Good point. Yeah,
and,
go ahead.
And I've noticed this when I worked with Native Americans also in the United States. But and to me, it was so refreshing because I'm such a kinesthetic, you know, and even though I do work at Alton and you have been talking about, you know, finding your place in the story and why does the emotion come up. Sometimes it, you know, emotion does come in the back door or down the chimney.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was at the Epic when they were telling up in Vancouver, B.C., when they were telling the Mabinogi and the Welsh mythology. And I had no idea that I would be so, I have a part of my family that's Welsh that I've never known much about. And all of a sudden, I was really resonating with the stories in a way I never had before.
Wow.
So when I got up to tell the story of Rhiannon and about how a monster steals her child and someone else finds it and raises it but then has to give it back when they find out it's really the prince, all of a sudden, tears were just streaming down my face. And I remembered a conversation I had had with Melanie Ray about, you know, how do you act when you cry? And she said, well, you can still talk. So I just talk. You know, don't let your throat constrict. So I just kept telling the story.
Yeah.
And the tears, you know, they went away. And then some of them came back when Rhiannon finally got her child back. But afterwards, is that when they do the Epic, they always invite community members that are from Wales or wherever the Epic is from to come. And so the Welsh people that got up out of their chairs when I was done and told me that they were so, touched and so thankful that somebody valued their story so much that they would actually feel them so deeply.
Wow.
And I thought they were going to say, you know, the storytellers would come and say, oh, damn it, Allison. You know, but, you know, I found that time and time again when I've gone to Canada or some other folk places overseas that there's a whole different way that emotions speak to people. And I certainly don't try to manifest them, but I find them much more valued. So I don't know if you've run across that. I certainly know that after working for in a government job for 20 years, that emotions were never valued. So I think part of it is our culture, our Western culture.
Yes,
but I didn't ever think Canada was so different.
Right. Well, bravo, and thank you for that that little cross-cultural data point there. That what I'm describing is Western culture or our kind of dominant culture, and it's not all cultures.
Right. And also to remember when we go across those borders, and it doesn't, you know, like I said, also with Native Americans. When I worked at the Maori in New Zealand, I mean, I find a real different way of telling sometimes that they think is profound.
Yeah.
And I don't try to make it happen, but when some of those things have bubbled up in me, people have thanked me for it when in other places I would have kind of scurried away and thought, God, I got to work on that some more.
Yeah.
So it's just another thought there.
Thank you. Well, the thing that, again, for me is key is you can tell through tears. You can tell while laughing. You can do all those things. The key thing is, are you taking care of the audience still, or are you expecting them to take care of you? Because the unspoken bargain is you're taking care of them. And as long as they can tell you're taking care of them, they will likely tolerate anything like that and, in fact, be moved by it.
Well, I think part of it has to do with being comfortable in our emotions.
That's right.
I mean, certainly it's not something I seek out, but if that's what comes up, then I need to, and I'm still there telling it, then I need to write it through, and it doesn't have to be the end of the show.
Right. Really good example of crossing the border with your full self intact.
Great. Is that a good place to stop, Doug?
It is for me.
Well, I thank you again for this lovely time together, and thank everybody for joining us.
Thank you.
A wonderful group. We're from about 8 different states, which is just wonderful magic bridging, and I really appreciate everyone's being here. So
thanks. See you at Albany next weekend.
Thank you.
Oh, yes. those of you who be sharing the fire,
have
see you then.
Bye all. Thanks so much, Doug. Bye-bye.
Bye,
Doug.
Thank you.
Bye.
Oh, bye.
Everybody.
Bye.
Thank you, Doug.
Bye.
Gail. Okay.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you.
Everybody.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Just hear me. Hey, Gail, are you there?
Yeah.
Yeah. I noticed that you're on freeconferencecall.com, and I would like to recommend to you freeconferencecalling.com. And one of the nice things about it is that you have the ability to control things on a web page, and you can actually mute everybody except for the speaker who has a separate code, and therefore you don't have to have this interruption as people come on late.
Huh.
And you can also turn off the entry tone, so you have a little bit more control that makes it a little smoother. Also, I've had really good experiences with them, and with freeconferencecall.com, I've had some terrible experiences.
Huh.
This was not one of them. Although I did get bounced off the
line.
And
how about recording?
It has free recording, and they keep it basically forever on their website. You can download it whenever you want to. So
you can put it on HSA's website.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Probably. Actually, you'd probably want to download it and put it on the site. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I will let Lonnie know, or whoever is going to take over and be in charge of this. That part
of
it.
Yeah.
Not me. But I've been happy to host a couple of them. Take that off Lonnie's plate.
Yeah.
So thank you. The only thing I regret is that I didn't give you a chance to tell people your contact information.
Oh, that's true. I didn't even think of it.
Well, why don't you send me what you'd like to say, and I will put it on the HSA listserv.
Okay.
And we had a lovely time last night with Doug, and here's, for anybody who's interested, his contact information.
Nice.
Just write me a little two sentence and send it to me, and I'll do that.
I'll do that.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Gail. It was
Take
really
care.
Fun. I really appreciate you making this happen.
Bye-bye.